Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Couple days late getting this one up, but that's okay because we've got a jam-packed podcast and a lot of good subjects to talk about today. We're going to take a deep dive into Fred's, who announced the closures of some new stores, but some new inventory initiatives as well. We'll talk also about an interesting real estate study from a company analyzing cell phone location data that kind of flew under the radar of most news outlets this past week. We'll also go back and talk a little bit about Rite Aid earnings, but not so much about the earnings part of it, more about some of their initiatives going on in the stores and initiatives that we'll be looking ahead to because Rite Aid pretty much got to dance with the person they brought at this point in time because not a lot of other strategic initiatives as far as selling or merging the company on the table. A quick reminder to like us and rate us however you do access us. Also, check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Retail Podcast. So we actually begin the stories on today's show with Rite Aid. Again, they revealed earnings last Thursday. The results, actually not bad. And we'll talk briefly about the earnings just to kind of refresh you on those. But more than anything, we're interested in the initiatives Rite Aid is planning to bring to the table now that they've pretty much got what they've got in terms of their store base. The big news as far as the financials were concerned is that adjusted earnings per share beat analyst estimates. Zacks' consensus estimates were a loss of 3 cents per share, but Rite Aid pulled even with last year at the same quarter, adjusted loss of 1 cent per share. Now, a loss, still a loss, but things look a lot better from the financial perspective than many had expected. Rite Aid, of course, has been in the news a lot over the past 3 years as the chains looked for strategic alternatives constantly, only to just be partially successful. They, of course, had an attempted merger with Albertsons that was scuttled after activist investor pressure. Not sure how well that worked out for the activist investors at hand there because their share price hasn't exactly taken off at that point in time. But also a deal with Walgreens, of course, to sell off some of their stores. It seems like they've been in constant flux. Now that's starting to settle down. We see that a little bit with their fourth quarter earnings.
Look at those earnings now and briefly look at those numbers, which again, aren't that great, but better than expected, which is good for the company. As far as their net loss is concerned, their adjusted net loss was right around $13.3 million. Sounds like a lot. This is up from last year's adjusted net loss of $7.8 million, but both still round to a loss of about 1 cent on a per share basis. Their adjustments for the loss this year include $197 million of income tax expense due to a valuation change, and last year, adjustments were largely related to legal fees associated with their merger attempts that Trent had already mentioned there. Revenues were the main negative surprise here, with retail pharmacy revenues being flat compared to the prior year. Not good, especially if you look at the larger picture in the pharmacy industry, but the same store sales were slightly up 0.7% year over year, and this was a factor of increased pharmacy sales, 2.1% up, on a 0.8% increase in the same store script count. And a lot of pharmacies use that number to really see their year over year performance, and decreased front end sales down 1.9%, which is pretty much the story of both CVS and Walgreens as well. But decreased front end sales for Rite Aid have marked the balance sheets of competitors Walgreens and CVS as well, which is something that we've been focused on through their earnings calls. Trying to spur those sales has been a little bit tough for those executives there. However, this decrease for Rite Aid outpaced all other quarterly front-end sales decreases in the past 3 years. The previous worst quarter was the first quarter of fiscal year 2019, which they reported a decline of 1.8%. On the other hand, the increase in pharmacy sales marks 3 straight quarters of increased pharmacy sales for Rite Aid, the first time that's happened in nearly 3 years, so it's not all bad for Rite Aid. They noted that this was especially impressive internally because of the relatively mild flu season over the winter. So less people getting sick, less people having to come in and fulfill prescriptions. Rite Aid also mentioned that the introduction of a few key generics resulted in 100 basis point negative impact on pharmacy sales. Again, something their main competitors have also recently noted. And if you look at the larger political news, you can see that there is this larger push in Congress to try to push out more generics a little bit more quickly to stave off more regulation that's really hurt the ability for generics to get on the market in a quick fashion. Honestly, while it was a miss for analysts, we felt like it was a bit optimistic for analysts to expect revenues from continuing operations higher than last year, especially for organic store closures, 82 all in the last fiscal year. Not making excuses for Rite Aid here, but we just didn't know what analysts were seeing. Margins were also impacted slightly by initiatives for the company as well. While the company did say margins were impacted by declining front store sales, products there have a higher margin generally. They also noted distribution costs as a main culprit. And as you might imagine, they were focused to realign their distribution network as a result of store divestments. And this makes sense because as soon as you try to minimize your store count, you do have to look at your distribution initiatives. The realignment was a bit too costly, however, but also necessary as they began to lose economies of scale and those efficiencies go by the wayside with a much smaller store network. It's entirely likely, looking ahead, that distribution costs remain higher as a percentage of sales than in the past few years for Rite Aid, given the smaller store network. And as we look towards those initiatives, Trent, you can see that, as with any other retailer, while we like to see the numbers with these financials, we're just as interested with their initiatives, especially in this case, with Rite Aid being in a constant state of flux over the past 3 years.
And as we talked about to lead off the show, now they have just a little bit more certainty about what the future might hold for the company. And as we talked about, they basically have to make it work with the store base they've got, barring a larger development on the mergers and acquisitions front. They mentioned long-term stability a lot on the call. They talked about that stability. They talked about sustainability as well, suggesting management knows they've pretty much got what they've got at this point in time. They did lead off the actual call itself with a couple of housekeeping notes. And first, the most important one, they were able to complete refinancing of their $2.7 billion revolving credit facility, pushing the maturities out to 2023. Of course, this helps with short-term liquidity, which has been kind of a battle for Rite Aid over the last few years. The second thing they noted is they approved a reverse stock split at a 20-to-1 ratio, so their stock price may appear larger coming up here in late April, but they'll have fewer outstanding shares remaining, of course, because of that reverse split. Now, because of that reduction in store count, they are trimming their management ranks to attempt to put SG&A, or selling general and administrative expenses, back into line. They expect $55 million in annual cost savings from the initiatives once complete, $42 million for just the next fiscal year alone, with the initiatives not yet finalized. And of course, when we say trimming their management ranks, of course, this means reassignments and, unfortunately, letting some people go. So there is, of course, a human cost to this. On the financial front, though, they felt like it was the right thing to do with a much smaller store base. Anytime you have that smaller store base, you're going to see the management ranks cut and you're going to see things streamlined a little bit, maybe from a 2 or 3 tier management system down to a 1 or 2 tier management system. As far as the store chain is concerned, they also hope to begin competing with Walgreens Boots Alliance and CVS in the clinic category, increasing their Ready Clinic initiatives to leverage their footprint in much the same way the others have. Ready Clinic is kind of what they call their in-store clinics here. This all began with a pilot of what they called the Rite Aid Health Alliance, which they said added a little bit of color to their understanding of the care market. And it's interesting that this came out because there was an article in the Detroit Free Press earlier this week talking a little bit about how people now are going more and more to these retail care centers in CVS and Walgreens and Rite Aid than they are going to their actual doctors or to urgent care centers. So we know this market is growing. Rite Aid knows this market's growing. And now they feel like they have a better understanding of this market as a whole because of their Rite Aid Health Alliance pilot. They plan on integrating some of these services into their wellness store footprint. So this is kind of a store refresh that's been glossed over, quite honestly, as all of these other things with Rite Aid were going on. But after remodels of recent vintage, the wellness store footprints actually account for 72% of their store base and makes it easier to integrate those clinics, the Ready Clinics, the Rite Aid Health Alliance initiatives into their stores. Another thing they've invested money in is prescription file buys. This is something that a lot of prescription retailers, a lot of pharmacy retailers do talk about. But Rite Aid, because of that liquidity issue, didn't really have a lot of money to spend on prescription file buys. Basically, buying files of certain patients from other particular pharmacists. They're looking to $60 million allocated for script files in fiscal year 2020, so this upcoming fiscal year, versus just $29 million 2 years ago. The idea there being able to bolster their pharmacy customer base. But Leighton, of more interest to us, really, their initiative to rework their front end.
One thing we don't hear a lot in the retail pharmacy industry is about front-end services, but this is something Rite Aid wants to bolster, akin to Walgreens having photo centers in many of their locations. In addition to services, the company said outright to expect more self-checkouts, which is amazing. This is a really good innovation for the retail pharmacy industry, but more self-checkouts at Rite Aid really, by the end of the year, means a lot more customer appreciation, more people coming in and out, and guess what? Less expenses long-term in terms of paying employees a salary. So this is a positive because front-end throughput can be a deterrent to retail pharmacy impulse buys as people are picking up prescriptions. Additionally, they are embarking on a new SKU optimization program across the board, not in any particular category, but the entire front-end. Specifically, they want SKUs with an emphasis on health and wellness, which really certifies their branding there rather than just appearing like a souped-up convenience store. They plan on achieving this in part through a better-for-you private brand, particularly in consumables and beauty. And I say better-for-you, that is going to be the brand name that they're trying to attain here. As an aside, we've always thought it was funny that a store like Walgreens is supposed to assist in overall health, but 90% of their front-end consumables are essentially unhealthy. If you look at their tobacco products behind the counter, things that they've been criticized for ever since CVS turned to CVS Health. CBD was also mentioned as something rolling out in Oregon and Washington as a pilot program. A huge part of what's been going on here lately is the CBD movement, potentially looking at some buys there. A huge part of the SKU optimization program will actually come through private label products, as you might imagine, as management seems worried that their brand equity has suffered in the wake of all of the negative merger talk in the media. As a result, they are relaunching their over-the-counter label Rite Aid Pharmacy in the quarter, and they also plan on introducing a bevy of new items to their private label collection and focusing on marketing their private label products a little bit more. Additionally, they are repositioning their Thrifty ice cream brand and expanding it. Another final item here that they mentioned is their partnership with Instacart to drive front-end delivery. They'd like to have this service work hand-in-hand with their prescription delivery service, providing convenience to the end user. And this sort of works out because it gives their core customers something to expect. They know that Instacart is going to be delivering all of their items, and it's going to work as efficiently as their current pharmacy rollout. As a nice bonus, they did reiterate their partnership with Amazon to place Amazon lockers in over 900 stores for pickup return of Amazon shipments. And this is something that we've seen with the likes of Kohl's, obviously, especially on the West Coast, but a lot of other retailers trying to optimize their square footage or their current location that in a lot of times has been at a particular corner for a long-standing amount of time. Their stock, Rite Aid stock, is trading around 45 cents. As of Tuesday the 16th. With that, we go on and transfer to our second story. Since we've been talking about Rite Aid, it only makes sense to discuss the news from late last week that Fred's, formerly Fred's Pharmacy, is planning a slew of closures. We don't like to dwell, Trent, too much on store closures. We leave that to the rest of the media out there, always talking about the thousands of annual closures as retail transitions to only online. Of course, we know that's not always the case, but this is a particularly substantial group of closures for Fred's that could signal the beginning of the end for Fred's. One could make the argument that the beginning of the end occurred when the company sold off its pharmacy division. We noted that in a previous podcast episode. This, after having done our due diligence and research on that story, noting that a lot of their pharmacies were actually already being handled by third-party providers. Without its pharmacy, Fred's is basically a Dollar General at this point, or a Family Dollar, without the benefit of scale. So they don't have a lot of scale with many of their stores, and the fact that they've been closing some steadily, and now they totally are hands-off in terms of getting that annualized revenue from their pharmacy divisions, which they pretty much don't own any at this point. Fred's announced on Thursday, April 11th, that they would be closing 159 stores by the end of May. The announcement came as part of a larger announcement trumpeting the retention of PJ Solomon as they continue to explore strategic alternatives. The stores were characterized as underperforming, these stores that they were targeted for closing. But as we've discussed in the past, store closures often have as much to do with where their stores fit into distribution networks and how easy it is to get out of leases as the actual store performance itself. Especially with someone who's not as big as Fred's, you have to look at the larger picture and how their financials play into their decisions about divesting stores. This much was basically confirmed by CEO Joseph Anto, who said in a statement that there was a particular focus on locations with shorter duration leases. There we go. We see that the fact that closing out a lease prematurely is much more expensive to the bottom line of a company, and therefore maybe not looking at that underlying performance for each individual location. He went on to say, their CEO did, that most of these stores have near-term lease expirations and limited remaining lease obligations. You know, at this point, that commercial landlords have already been making plans for a post-Fred's world and are likely out in front of any potential closures, or at least if you're a landlord, owner, maybe a REIT that has a Fred's Pharmacy or a former Fred's Pharmacy in a retail location of yours, that you should be going out, getting feelers, getting an understanding of that local market to see if anybody's going to be interested in that space going forward. This is a natural process for commercial landlords who have national credit tenants who are in rough financial shape and insist on short-term leases. The 159 stores, by the way, is reflective of over 28% of the remaining 557 store base, and they are spread evenly throughout 13 states. A large number of them are more in rural areas, and notice a lot of closings in mountainous regions in Arkansas and Tennessee, for example.
Now, they've hired the liquidation firms Malfitano Advisors and SB360 Capital Partners to manage the liquidation process, and SB360 actually comes in a little bit later on. Now, it'll be interesting to see in this case how much merchandise, if any, is reallocated to the rest of their store base versus clearanced out in the closing stores. And the reason we say this is because some of their existing store base is also going to be involved in what's called a total inventory blowout at the same time. And to that end, SB360 Capital Partners is also assisting in that part. It's a total inventory blowout is what Fred's is calling at 360 other stores. Only around 7% of their overall stores are not participating in the clearance. And actually, it's kind of rare to see a liquidation firm give a quote to a media outlet. We're used to seeing Great American Partners and the like kind of do their work in silence. But Ziggy Schaefer of SB360 said that this additional clearance event will bring, and I quote, value on top of value for customers, and that most discounts in the actual stores that are not closing are around 5 to 20% the lowest ticketed price, very similar to the liquidations that are going on at the closing stores. And just like at the closing stores, it's going to be pretty much store-wide. Another SB360 executive, Aaron Miller, actually told USA Today that the sales should be a major traffic driver, especially for those locations in rural areas. And to this, we say, yeah, it's probably going to be a traffic driver, but at what cost? Already, Fred's is a company that's struggling on the margin front. Now you're providing that additional liquidation discount at those stores that are remaining open going forward. And there are a lot of odd things about this. We'll kind of break it down here, but one of the first things that we found odd is that Miller said that consumables would be restocked throughout the sale, suggesting that other merchandise might not be restocked. But they mentioned consumables like milk and bread were going to be restocked throughout the sale. But that leaves the question, what are you not restocking? And the reason we asked that question is because this is actually something Fred said they had an issue with, is not restocking items on time at a lot of their stores. All of this kind of seems to us like this is a pre-liquidation liquidation for those stores that are remaining open, with the company attempting to squeeze as much as they can out of current inventory before potentially eventually shuttering for good in the future. Now, the Wall Street Journal did report 2 weeks ago that Fred's has no immediate plans to close or file for bankruptcy, but it's hard not to see the writing on the wall here. During their last earnings call, Fred's really didn't discuss much as far as inventory numbers were concerned, as far as maybe having too much inventory. However, cost of goods sold, which also includes inventory measures oftentimes, was very high as a percentage of net sales. We were looking at 74% and was up from 73.5% as a percentage of net sales the year prior. But like I mentioned, when it comes to inventory, another odd thing about these Fred's clearancing initiatives is that they claim it's to right-size and reorganize their in-store inventory. However, that just doesn't mesh with their inventory situation currently, at least according to their CEO, Joe Anto, on their latest earnings call. Now, their latest earnings call took place a few months ago. It was for their fiscal third quarter. And on that call, Anto said that they actually felt that their front store struggles in the third quarter were as a result of out of stocks more than anything. So it wasn't because of a bulk of inventory that they weren't moving. It was because they were running out of stock of the inventory their customers wanted most. In fact, he went so far as to say that it was a problem throughout the chain and that they were focused on staffing further in supply chain to make it such that out of stocks would not continue to be an issue. And he did mention the optimization of inventory levels, but what we've got here is much more like a wholesale clearance, whereas the optimization of inventory levels, oftentimes we're thinking of a selective clearance, like what you might have going on at JCPenney or a retailer like that when they talk about optimizing those inventory levels. And that wholesale clearance is exactly what we've got going on here. So you look at a company that just said a few months ago that their problem was having too much out of stock, and suddenly they're doing this massive inventory blowout across the entire store. You have to wonder what their new SVP of merchandising thinks about these measures, or if he's potentially a driving force behind them. Their new SVP of merchandising is Michael O. Young, who was hired in 2018. He had experience from Michaels and Walmart in merchandising positions. One of their first initiatives with O. Young at the helm was beginning to sell closeouts in their stores, a la Big Lots or Ollie's. And this may be the direction the company chooses to head going forward, especially after this, what they called an inventory blowout. But they'll have to balance this with their aims of being an everyday retailer with household essentials. And we should still remember that they do have pharmacies in certain locations still. Now, as far as closeouts are concerned, they went so far as to say they had plans in place to build out infrastructure to scale the closeout offerings up. And they wanted to scale those further in this fiscal year to become more of a store where people think about that bargain hunt associated with closeouts. They're also excited about the inclusion of wine and beer in a large number of the stores. And you'd have to think that because of legal regulations, of course, and other things, that both of these products, wine and beer, are also excluded from those store-wide clearance efforts. So it's so interesting to have a company doing this total inventory blowout, basically a pre-liquidation, as we say, when just a little bit ago they were talking about, oh, our problem in the front of store is having too much that's out of stock. Our problem in the front of store is really not having enough of those closeouts, and we want to scale up on the closeouts. Maybe they're getting rid of inventory to do those measures, but it seems like two steps back to take just one step forward.
It certainly does. Another interesting juxtaposition as these clearance efforts are going forward, like Rite Aid, Fred's is doubling down on private label products. They planned on introducing 200 new private label products before the end of the 2018 fiscal year. This comes along with an effort to reduce prices on strategic items through input from Nielsen Analytics. Again, that's not really what we're seeing here with the wide store sales going on, but all of this is interesting to us because as they continue to close stores, they'll continue to lose out on benefits from scale that companies get when you talk private label products. You think Costco, Target, all of those private label products that those companies sell come at far greater margins because of their scale and ability to leverage their branding. It may be a little bit more difficult on the buyers as well here for Rite Aid's concept to attempt to squeeze prices down even as order quantities also decrease. For a company whose gross margin continues to decline, there are a lot of red flags here in our opinion. They don't typically take questions on calls, so there has been no chance for analysts to dig deeper into the issues the chain has experienced or any of their new initiatives to drive sales. The announcements came along with another message. They were going to once again, and I quote, evaluate strategic alternatives. The last time they did so, they reached a deal to sell off their pharmacies in 179 locations to Walgreens for around $165 million, which is something I had mentioned just previously. They also changed their name from Fred's Pharmacy just to Fred's. Fred said in an announcement that they were still pursuing a sale of remaining pharmacy assets beyond the ones already divested. At this point, it's a serious question as to whether any of the company's assets besides the ones tied up with the pharmacy hold any value to any other companies. Their competitors are probably looking at their remaining store locations and sort of just shrugging, because even though they are in a lot of rural markets, they are near other regional competitors, something you have to factor into the equation. Real estate, of course, is one facet. A budding grocer like Harps may be interested in some of their store footprints. Outside of that, when we really put our minds to it, even if Dollar Tree or Family Dollar were to make a play for the remaining store locations, a number of them would have to close due to competing locations in close proximity. So again, you have that location factor really not playing an advantage to Fred's remaining locations. The general tone surrounding the company over the last few earnings calls has been one of their strengthening balance sheet. You think of all of the debt they've been able to pay off from that Walgreens interest in their pharmacy locations. However, in their most recent quarter, fiscal year 2018's third quarter, they recorded a loss of $30.8 million. And while this was better than the prior year, it's still not sustainable. If we were the leaders of this company, it would still be alarming to look at their balance sheet and income statement for the long term, especially as the company seeks to pay down long-term debt by selling assets off. It's just not something that's going to be sustainable, something akin to what Sears did not that long ago. Missing from their last few calls, too, is the talk of sustainability as a business model in whole, one that Rite Aid focused so closely on during their last call, really gave transparency into their call and their methodology going forward, whereas with Fred's, you just don't see it.
And now, for the first time in several weeks, we go back to retail real estate as a company analyzing cell phone location data produces a report of interest for malls and REITs alike. Now, the company releasing the report is Thasos, which takes aggregated data from cell phone locations to produce a variety of intriguing reports. Generally, however, their bread and butter is foot traffic analysis, meaning this is a name we'll be hearing a lot more from in the retail realm. Now, their flagship product is called Consumer Streams, which offers that geolocation data retailers always looking for. They're founded, Thasos was, in 2011, and they basically pride themselves on taking massive amounts of cell phone geolocation data and distilling it into useful data for real estate investors, retailers, and others. And no, this isn't an advertisement for Thasos, just giving you some background on the company as we present this particular study. And in this case, Thasos sought to find the most valuably trafficked retail REITs, and they divided things into a couple of categories. The main categories, open air and enclosed retail properties. Now, before we get into the story further, it bears mention that these rankings aren't a result of an organic Thasos methodology, so the results may not suggest exactly who the top performing shopping center owners in the country are, nor are they looking at just raw traffic data, because the traffic data might be a little bit different from the data that Thasos is coming up with. So the methodology begins first with kind of defining a trade area, which shows how large of a net the shopping center casts, so to speak. Basically, it measures where customers of a shopping center are coming from. And then Thasos puts that data against Census Bureau data about the customers' home markets to give properties a score based around six different performance indicators. And these performance indicators include things like visitation growth and household income of those that are visiting, as well as property value of those that are visiting, and other metrics that kind of suggest the effectiveness of the traffic. In other words, this data isn't out to just measure the raw foot traffic or measure the people that are going to the stores person by person, but rather how impactful that foot traffic might be to retailers in that shopping center, whether the traffic is actually spending money or whether that traffic is willing to spend money based on other demographic data. Basically, they're attempting to adjust traffic numbers to add a bit of color as far as visitors themselves are concerned. Now, the other reason they've broken down data in this way is to avoid the traditional ring trap, or what can be called the ring trap. For those who may not know, when real estate developers or retailers or investors are gauging success of a potential retail property or potential success of that retail property, they'll often draw a ring of a certain radius around it to gather data. Now, the ring is traditionally 1 or 5 miles, but we've seen some rings be drawn fairly creatively, shall we say, so as to include some more beneficial demographic information. One ring we saw on a retail property for sale this year had kind of a jagged 13-mile radius that was supposed to measure kind of the outline of a city, but in reality, it was kind of cut to include the higher demographics around that particular area. And Thassos's point behind attempting to hone in closer on this data is to account for those living within the ring who don't shop at shopping centers in question, and those who live outside the ring who actually make the trip to those shopping centers. Maybe they find those shopping centers more beneficial to them and what they're looking to do than those shopping centers in what would be their own 1 to 5 mile ring. And moreover, it might be instructive here to find out if the people from outside the ring that make the trip are willing to spend money more than those inside the ring, or vice versa, because it might give a more accurate definition to the traffic capabilities of a retail center. So now that we've gone through all of the methodology and talked a little bit about why this information is important, Leighton, let's get into the results here.
Yeah, among those results, you can see that in closed retail properties, Thassos found Westfield to be the best performer by their metrics. Runners-up to Westfield include Taubman Centers, Pennsylvania REIT, and Simon. Simon, who has been on our timeline, at least over the past few years, during the podcast and the discussion about their earnings. Simon caught us by surprise, as an underlying rental metrics have been good as of late, but not great. And they've been one of those slower firms to divest some of their older indoor mall properties. We see that some of their properties are maybe what you would consider B-minus properties in terms of their malls throughout the United States. As far as open-air properties are concerned, Urstadt Biddle led the way. Washington REIT and Saul Centers were right behind them. Some surprise there, as strong performers like Agree and Spirit don't fall into the top part of this category. In terms of sample size, the data is pretty profound. Thassos found that the data for 95% of the retail properties in the United States owned or operated by the largest publicly traded REITs. This is a lot of data, and of course, data for private REITs in terms of shopping center ownership would be much harder to come by. I live in Orange County, so a lot of people tend to think the Irvine Company, which is one of the largest private REITs in the world. There was data that stood out for some of us from this publication. First, they noted that despite calls about the retail apocalypse in 2016, 2017, 2018, and 2019, mall traffic actually peaked in late 2017. So media can take that for what it's worth, but this is a counter to much of what was written off by retail analysts and experts who did not necessarily have data or access to this data. And this also means that all the stores inside shopping centers who have struggled or declared bankruptcy have had the opportunities with the mall traffic. So they just simply did not capitalize on the opportunities to garner those sales from all of those pedestrians walking by their stores. They may have just not had the right merchandising or right merchandise in the first place. They also noted that since late 2017, traffic has recently begun to decline, particularly in 2019. So this is perhaps worrisome for some. This decline is somewhat expected based off of the first quarter guidance from a number of retailers who we've covered, who are expecting flat or even negative same-store sales in the first few months of 2019. This, again, off the back, I should say, a caveat here being a massively successful November and December of 2018. In a weird twist, much of this decline has actually been fueled by outlet malls, whose meaningful traffic apparently saw sharp declines beginning in July of last year. We see a lot of closures there in that space as well. Why this happened is anyone's guess, especially with the apparent strength of a lot of off-price retail right now. You think of Ross and TJ Maxx, or maybe it is because of the strength of off-price retail that this is simply happening. The outlet complex nearest Trent, actually, you mentioned this earlier to me when we were not recording, has seemed not to see a decline, as it pretty much is a madhouse at all times of the year. There's also a complex by me that is considered sort of half off price, half full price outlet store concept. Does very well at all times of the year, perhaps because the weather is nice where I live now. But either way, not a good sign for REITs like Tanger, who have the majority of their holdings in massive outlet complexes. Thassos also said that grocery-anchored open-air malls are continuing to outperform other malls, but the rate of outperformance was closed in upon 2018. It will be interesting to see if the new landscape of grocery delivery or grocery pickup affects grocery-anchored traffic over the next few years. Even still, a number of retailers, Pet Supplies Plus being one example, Ace Hardware being another, covet the grocery-anchored center as an ideal real estate space to do business in, and we don't see a lot of that changing anytime soon. Again, this is our opinion. Along those same lines, Thassos said, beginning in 2018 or January 2018, strip centers that did not have major anchor tenants began to actually outperform those anchored by big box stores. A major revelation for us, Trent, but not the last piece of news here.
No, and by the way, that particular part of it, I think, speaks more to the effectiveness of a lot of the open-air centers that don't have those traditional anchors, that might have kind of the sub-anchors that might be 15,000 to 20,000 square feet, but you're looking at those centers suddenly being a little bit more effective in terms of drawing traffic to the traditional malls and traditional anchored centers there. And that last piece of news from this data is the data suggests that what they call experiential tenants, something that we've heard mall operators talking a lot about over the last several months, they don't give shopping centers actually a meaningful lift as far as the traffic that they are measuring. So once again, Thassos is looking at this through the lens of meaningful traffic, or traffic that may be more likely to spend money at the shopping center. So we're not just talking about raw traffic numbers here. So while a lot of REITs may claim that these tenants are traffic drivers because of their experiential nature, they may not be driving the right traffic, according to this data. Thassos gave Tesla, Apple, and Starbucks Reserve all mentions as examples of experiential tenants here, but there are other experiential tenants that we've talked about in the past, tenants that ideally are supposed to be interactive with children or adults in certain ways that drive traffic to those centers. The big thing is they may not be driving the right traffic to those centers going forward. So this is a big question that's got to be answered by those open air and enclosed shopping centers going forward, is how do you continue to try to drive that traffic if the experiential tenants aren't the ones that are driving the most effective traffic?
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I look ahead at a story that we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. And we begin with Leighton.
Has to do with yet another earnings call. This time, we didn't cover it during the normal news rundown, but we look towards Pier 1, as on Wednesday of last week, they reported fourth quarter net sales fell 19.5%. This number was totally beyond what we were thinking was going to happen with the company. While the company in Pier 1 has been struggling as of late, it has not been struggling to that great of degree. They've actually had a lot of omni-channel initiatives that we think were impressive, but it has just apparently not translated into higher traffic or higher revenue for the company quarter over quarter. You see, because it was their fourth quarter report that you can get the full fiscal year 2019 report, where in they had sales fall 13.7%. That's not good. My looking ahead has to do with the fact that they now have a new interim CFO amid all of these growing financial problems with the company. They reported a net loss of $68.8 million in the fourth quarter. This includes part of their transformational cost and restructuring cost. This certainly doesn't help their bottom line, but I'm just curious to see what their new CFO is going to be able to do. As Pier 1 appointed a new CFO, effective immediately, replacing Nancy Walsh, who served as executive vice president and principal financial officer. And you look towards a lot of their experience there on their board, on their executive team. You just have to wonder, what is going to right this ship? Are they going to have to keep maybe looking at stores to close? Are they going to have to continue to restructure? Because as long as you're having to pay those restructuring fees now, you're trying to transform how your company works. You're trying to transform your distribution network after around 2 years of having started some of these initiatives. You have to wonder, where are they going to go from here? Is their model simply just antiquated enough such that if you go into a Pier 1 next year, it's essentially going to be the same thing as going into a Pier 1 from a decade ago? I'm curious to see where they go and if a CFO, or at least a new interim CFO, can really fundamentally change the business, because it's not just about financial logistics here. It's about getting customers to care for your product, and that's what I'm looking most towards.
And one other thing that I'm looking towards regarding Pier 1 is, of course, they announced a store closures plan, going to look to close a handful of stores for sure, maybe up to 145 stores if they can't meet performance metrics. And I'm anxious to see kind of how the media covers that, because we've kind of known the writing on the wall there for Pier 1 for a long time as far as these store closures. In fact, we were kind of talking about it all the way back in 2016 when Pier 1 said, hey, we're fully omnichannel and this is going to help to drive traffic. We were kind of critical of those initiatives and pointed to Pier 1 as a retailer whose balance sheet didn't look all that promising, and they didn't have that mechanism to turn same-store sales around. There was no magic bullet that they had. So I'm interested to see whether they'll just be lumped into the rest of the retail apocalypse talk, or if the media will actually kind of look deeper into the issues that caused the Pier 1 closures in the first place. And again, those closures have been a long time coming. What I'm looking ahead to actually this week is another story regarding Sears. We just recently talked about positives regarding Sears in that they were opening a few stores throughout the country, smaller format stores. Well, it was released this week that Sears is actually suing Eddie Lampert, Sears Holdings, that is, so not Transform Hold Co., which is the current iteration of Sears, but Sears Holdings is suing Eddie Lampert and a number of other former board members for basically extracting value out of the former Sears Holdings without actually returning any benefit to the company. And this has to do with not only the spinoff of Land's End, but also the creation of Seritage Growth Properties, which was, of course, the company's REIT there. And the lawsuit basically says that Eddie Lampert and company received a disproportionate share of benefits from the spinoff, and it kind of left Sears Holdings out to dry. So it seems in this case like, you know, hey, positive news for Sears. They're going forward, and they just cannot escape their own shadow at this point. It seems like we're going to be talking about not only the bankruptcy, but what led them into bankruptcy for quite some time. You have to wonder if this is going to hinder, of course, Sears' efforts to move forward out of the bankruptcy as Transform Hold Co., or exactly what will come from this particular lawsuit. And I think just from an outsider's perspective, I think there's no question that there was a lot of value extracted from Sears Holdings before they went bankrupt. Also, probably not a lot of question about mismanagement at Sears, whether it be from Eddie Lampert or others at the company, because you're going to have that anytime you kind of reach bankruptcy. We talked about Shopko several months ago and their march towards bankruptcy and how there might have been potentially some egregious mismanagement there. But overall, you just kind of have to wonder where this lawsuit's going to head and whether that's going to perhaps curtail some of Transform Holdco's initiatives going forward. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. We'll be back with you probably shorter than a week from now since we had to delay recording on this edition. Also, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast, and we'll be back with you soon.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.